Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2008. Ruination, the early years.
Welcome back to Ruination, the early years. We are diving deep, really deep, into the big fatty online archives again. This time, we're tackling the second official week. That's February 11th through the 15th, 2008. We're past that initial launch chaos now, and you start to see, well, the daily BFO ritual is really taking shape incredibly fast, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
If week one felt like, you know, finding the light switch, week two just bursts in. It got immediately branded VD Week. Valentine's Day week, obviously. And that name, it just perfectly captured this contradiction, didn't it?
It really did. How so?
Well, it was overflowing with genuine affection, you know,
especially
the shout outs to listeners. But then the content itself could be deeply irreverent, shocking sometimes. This week, I think, is where the BFO structure really clicks into place. It sort of gave Big Fatty this framework.
A necessary framework, yeah.
Exactly. To balance his, like, intense obsession with reality TV, which we'll definitely get into, with these incredibly personal, sometimes outrageous stories, all jammed into that tight, daily 20-minute format.
That structure enabling the chaos, that's really our mission today, figuring that out.
All right.
We're going to unpack the key guest appearances, those explosive Big Brother updates.
Oh boy.
Yeah, the predictions alone.
Right. And the listener questions, some of which were, let's say, pretty controversial, and maybe most importantly, the specific BFO rituals. The things that became non-negotiable parts of the show's identity, like right away in this crucial second week, we really need to understand how these early choices just defined what the BFO became.
Okay, let's start with something that sounds like a failure, but was almost instantly flipped into a win, or at least part of a brand.
You mean the iTunes thing?
Exactly. The iTunes resistance, you called it. Week two, the show's running daily. Everything seems fine, technically, except it's still not approved by the iTunes store. And Big Fatty mentions this a lot, like at the start of several shows this week.
But not like, oh no, poor us. It was almost like a badge of honor, wasn't it? It totally was. The show was basically ruined before it even got on the biggest platform. This technical problem, this inability for people to easily subscribe, he made it a talking point. It signaled that, you know, the BFO was kind of an outlaw show. It wasn't frustration he was projecting. It was more like validation, this anti-establishment thing.
And you see that reflected in the listener feedback he shared, right? Like Scotty from Australia.
Yeah, Scotty actually thanked Big Fatty for reminding him that he couldn't unsubscribe, even if he wanted to.
It's brilliant in a way, turning Apple's gatekeeping into this running gag about how listeners are basically trapped, forced loyalty.
And then there was DJ David J. He kicked off Tuesday's show, episode 8, just flat out saying, iTunes does not like the Big Fatty.
Just lays it out there.
Yeah, it creates this instant, like, insider vibe with the audience. You know, if you were listening, you had to find it. You weren't just stumbling across it easily. It just added another layer to that whole ruined identity. You were part of the underground, sort of.
Okay, so from that kind of forced exclusion to hyperconnection, we absolutely have to talk about the listener map.
Oh, the map. Yeah.
This wasn't just a cute little feature on the website. He presented it as, like, vital, essential. The show relied on you, the listener, participating.
And the consequence for just lurking, for not joining.
Uh-huh. You might get the F finger. That was the explicit threat.
The stakes were weirdly high for just putting a pin on a map, but it worked. The map became this, like, microcosm of the whole BFO project. It was super participatory and really personal.
He didn't just read out names, did he?
No, no. He'd give these little anecdotes, specific details about how people found the show, which, you know, validated their effort. Like Eric the Southern Boy. He found this other podcast, Vera Speaks, with Auntie Vera, and that connection led him to the BFO.
So Big Fatty's not just mapping his listeners. He's mapping this whole little niche podcast world they all inhabit.
Exactly. And you see that world interacting immediately. Like Michael from Stout Guy Germany. He came over from the QCast connection, which we'll get to later.
Oh, we will.
And right away, he's jumping into the drama. He's asking about British John's age, wondering if he's 24 and what dog years.
The listeners are instantly invested in the characters. It's like a little soap opera.
Totally. And the roll call just keeps going, showing Big Fatty's delight in finding these kindred spirits. You had Chuck and Chris from Huntsville, Alabama. Their description was perfect BFO, born intelligent, but education ruined them.
That's the ethos right there. Smart, curious, but totally dismissive of like formal structures.
Yeah. And Walt from Albany, New York, he was already involved with a show called We're Stupid Because You're Mean. Big Fatty wasn't just collecting listeners. He was finding collaborators, fellow travelers.
And the community could be demanding. What about Diane from the Tasty Jewelry?
Right. She only got her official hello after sending Big Fatty an e-letter spanking.
Because he forgot.
Well, he thought he'd already mentioned her. Something about Austin and oil can Harry's. But she called him out, demanded her mention, and boom, he gave it to her.
So the audience could actually, like, correct the record, influence the show directly.
Absolutely. It showed the editorial process was kind of governed by the loudest voices, in a way. And the map just kept growing that week.
Yeah.
Susan from New Wilmington, Pennsylvania, Big Fatty, dubbed her Love American Style because her picture was red, white, and blue, tying it into VD Week.
Always bringing it back to the theme.
And Spencer from Superior, Wisconsin, his description. Just a cheese.
Just a cheese. Okay.
And the map wasn't just names. It was visual chaos, too, which was crucial.
You mean Kim Beaver?
Exactly.
Yes.
Kim Beaver posted a new picture of her beaver. And Big Fatty immediately told everyone, like, you got to go look at this right now.
It's normalizing this kind of low stakes digital flashing almost.
Yeah. And then Monique from Kyle, Texas. She'd originally put up a picture of a tree in her backyard. Big Fatty thought that was weird, said so on the show.
So she changed it.
She changed it, swapped it for her actual photo.
Yeah.
So the community's actively shaping its own weird, semi-anonymous look, basically based on whether Big Fatty approves or not.
Okay, speaking of things Big Fatty felt compelled to share, we have to circle back to the coal mine, his day job.
The real world anchor.
Yes.
And specifically, the skull update.
Remind us who the skull was.
The skull was the receptionist at his work, the coal mine. She had retired the previous June, but she was this recurring character, this symbol of, you know, everyday workplace absurdity.
And the update for VD Week was?
Pure BFO horror, apparently. The skull came back to visit the office on Valentine's Day wearing a black sweater with hearts on it.
Oh, dear.
Big Fatty described it as a horrifying sight, said it ruined his day. But he insisted he had to share this vision with the listeners.
It grounds the show, doesn't it? No matter how wild the online stuff gets, he's still dealing with questionable fashion choices at the office.
It connects his real life to the show's content. Okay, let's shift to a more structured segment. Memory Lane music.
Which, for VD Week, was obviously themed around love.
Loosely, yes. But these weren't just any old love songs. They were incredibly specific niche TV themes. Chosen because they kind of, sort of related to love.
Okay, Monday, Feb 11th. What did we get?
Theme from The Love Boat. Love, exciting and new.
A classic.
Yep. But the trivia he pulled out was pure Big Fatty. He stated that Charo appeared on The Love Boat more than any other actress, called her amazing.
Did you add any commentary?
Oh, yeah. Ed, she must be 150 by now, but it's still coochie coochie. So you get the nostalgia, the random trivia, and a little bit of slightly off-color celebrity commentary.
That tracks. Okay, Wednesday.
Wednesday was the theme from Love American Style. And he didn't just play it. He tuned out the specific instruments. Flugelhorn, flute, and harp.
He's really focusing on the detail.
He is. He's framing the music through its, like, technical construction, reminding you he knows this stuff deeply. He mentioned the show itself ran 69 to 74 hour-long love-themed skits.
And Thursday, Valentine's Day itself, this must have been the most relevant one.
Well, the connection was maybe the most tenuous. He played the theme from Room 222.
Room 222. What's the love connection there? It was about a history class, right?
Right. It was. Walt Whitman High School. The connection. The show starred Karen Valentine.
Ah, Karen Valentine. Got it. VD Week logic.
Exactly. And he even used, like, the official sounding description for her character. A fidgety and somewhat wacky student teacher.
Where did he get that from? Sounds like Wikipedia.
Probably. But using that specific, almost academic detail about this pretty obscure 70s show, it just highlights his commitment. Stick with the BFO and you will learn this very specific, maybe useless trivia. It's a signal to the long-term listeners, like, we share this unique cultural background.
Okay, so structure is key. Let's see how that structure allows the chaos to really bloom. Section 2, reality TV. Specifically, Big Brother.
Yeah, this is where VD Week timing was just perfect. Big Brother 9 premiered on Tuesday, February 12th. The theme, Till Death Do Us Part.
And Big Fatty didn't just plan to recap it. He jumped in before it even aired with a contest.
A pretty provocative one, too. He posted pictures of the 9 male contestants. and asked listeners to vote. Guess which two were gay?
Wow.
He said he was kind of keeping a tally, using stereotypes for entertainment, driving engagement. That's classic early BFO. It was designed to get a reaction, get people involved, make them feel like they were part of the show's editorial direction.
And it worked immediately. It produced Anthony's gaydar voice letter.
Oh, Anthony from Ashanti No Lemon.
Yes.
He called in, claimed he had an extremely fine-tuned gaydar.
C-dar, right.
And then he just went down the list of guys, psychoanalyzing them based purely on their headshots. It was incredible.
But Big Fatty didn't just play it for laughs, did he? He sort of endorsed it.
He totally did. He validated Anthony. He reminded listeners that Anthony used to give dating advice on Archer's old shows.
Sure.
So, like, Anthony had credentials in this area. His gaydar was presented as a legitimate BFO tool.
That's how the show builds its own kind of authority, isn't it? By validating these really non-traditional forms of expertise.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's run down Anthony's predictions, because the specifics mattered for the tally. He said, Adam gay. Alex Jacob leaning towards gay. James gay. Joshua cute but straight, gave off the gay look, but not the gay vibe, apparently. Matt gay. Neil straight. Parker probably gay. And Ryan probably gay or bi.
Wait, how many is that? That's like 6 out of 9 leaning gay or bi, based on a photo.
Yep, according to the guitar. And the pre-show listener tally. Adam was way out in front as the predicted big ol' homo.
So much anticipation built before the show even started.
Totally. Big Fatty promised updates before Tuesday night's premiere. But he did admit he was a bit fuzzy on the season subtitle, Till Death Do Us Part. Said he was not quite sure what that means. Ready for the gay predictions? Maybe not the actual plot.
Well, the plot twists came fast, and he brought in reinforcements for that. Chef Mark.
Ah, yes. Chef Mark for the reality roundup. Mark was positioned as the true insider. Why? Because he got the Showtime After Dark feed, the uncensored one.
And he admitted he was hooked.
Oh, yeah. Called himself a junkie. Stayed up all night watching the live feeds. So the BFO wasn't just giving you a recap. It was giving you the dirt straight from the guy mainlining the raw footage.
So what was the big deal with Big Brother 9's setup?
Conflict by design. 16 people total, 9 men, 7 women, paired up by Big Brother as soulmates.
Soulmates, okay.
And get this, no single beds. Couples had to sleep together. Some pairs even had to sleep on the floor. Talk about forced intimacy and discomfort from day one.
Sounds like a recipe for drama.
Mark confirmed it. Chaos instantly. He said the conflict level felt like week 8, but it was only day 1. Alliances formed and broke. Like, immediately.
And they dropped a bombshell from the live feeds?
Huge one. Revealed that one contestant came into the house with both a girlfriend and a boyfriend on the outside. Neither of whom was their assigned soulmate partner in the house.
That is complicated. And perfect BFO fodder.
Exactly. So the drama builds to the first eviction, Wednesday night, which was episode 9 of the BFO. Initially, the focus seemed to be on Sheila and Adam, the two oldest, described as the bitchiest. They were on the block.
But they weren't the ones who went home.
Nope. The drama ended up centering on Jacob, described as a frat boy cutie pie, but also an ass. He was paired with his actual ex-girlfriend, Sharon, and he got voted out.
Okay, so eviction happened. End of story.
Not for the BFO reality roundup. Chef Mark, using his insider knowledge, hinted at justice in the universe. A huge shakeup in the house that nobody saw coming.
Ooh, a cliffhanger.
Totally. Setting up massive anticipation for the Sunday night Big Brother episode. Mark even pointed out Big Fatty hadn't watched the super late night 3 a.m. feeds yet, making the BFO essential listening if you wanted the scoop before the broadcast show.
Beyond Big Brother, he also touched on Survivor, right? Season 16.
Yeah, fans versus favorites, just started. He noted the fans beat the favorites in the first episode, but his analysis was pure cynical Big Fatty.
What was his take?
He theorized that Johnny Fairplay wanted to get voted off first, which he did. Why? So he could just chill and sequester for the whole season, get paid, basically, right, without actually having to compete or starve.
That's a very specific, insidery, and kind of hilarious theory, mocking the whole system.
Exactly. And one more correction from Chef Mark this week, showing the community keeping Big Fatty honest.
On what?
Sports geography. Big Fatty had made some claim about states with pro teams. Mark called in to correct him about the New York Giants.
Ah, the old Giants Jets playing in New Jersey thing.
Yep. Mark pointed out their mailing address might say New York, but they play in Jersey. So add another state to the count.
Did Big Fatty accept the correction?
He conceded the specific point about the Giants, yeah. But then immediately clarified his original argument, saying he wasn't counting WNBA or Major League Soccer teams anyway.
So classic Big Fatty. accepts the fact, but still kind of wins the argument by redefining the terms.
You got it. He engages,
yeah,
but he reserves the right to control the frame.
All right, let's move into section three, the gaze segment. This was only the second installment, right?
Second time ever. And it instantly delivered the BFO's first big dose of, like, meta podcast drama. Internal conflict spilling out.
Who was the guest?
British John, co-host of the QCast Connection. Big Fatty introduced him, playfully, as the 24-year-old straight man who's gay as a giggle in Big Fatty's book.
Okay, setting the stage. And the QCast Connection was important context here.
Crucial. QCast was like an early partner show, sort of in the BFO orbit. And British John explained how he knew Michael and Kevin from QCast. They all worked together at a theater, their version of the Coal Mine, about 5 years before.
So they had history.
Yeah. And he had first appeared on their show via a surprise call on Boxing Day. And here's the key. British John confirmed he lives with Michael and Kevin.
Ah. So any drama isn't between strangers online. It's between housemates.
Exactly. Which makes what happens next even juicier. But first, John had to address that age comment from Michael in Germany.
The 24 and what dog years crack.
Right. British John handled it pretty smoothly. He blamed his receding hairline for making him look older, but then pivoted, saying he was just vastly knowledgeable and worldly and charming, packed into a young body.
Basically, I look old because I'm so smart.
Pretty much. He called himself all of the knowledge without the sag. It was quick brand management, you know? Addressing a listener's jab by instantly reframing himself.
Did he offer any British quirks as requested?
He struggled a bit at first, seemed genuinely unsure what was quirky about him, but he offered a few specifics. Drinks tea with milk, not cream. Likes his toast done only on one side.
Toast on one side. Okay, that's mildly quirky.
Yeah. And he just generally noted the cultural friction between the UK and US, even though they share a language. These little details help anchor that British identity he was presenting, which becomes important later.
But the main event of his segment was the good gosh and gay moment.
Oh, a classic story. He set the scene perfectly. Schubert Alley, New York Theater District, near the stage door, the Loudoun area, for the musical Gypsy, starring Patti LuPone, a huge gay icon.
Okay, prime territory. What happened?
He sees this interaction. A guy he describes as a theater queen approaches a stagehand, a heavyset Brooklyn kind of, here you doing kind of guy moving equipment.
The setup is already perfect.
Right. The theater queen keeps asking, is Patti here? Is Patti here? The stagehand finally says, yeah, she's in rehearsal. You can't see her.
And the queen's reaction.
Apparently he got kind of teary eyed, then just starts to cry in the street. Full on meltdown.
Over not seeing Patti LuPone during rehearsal.
And his lament, according to British John, was just breathtakingly dramatic. Is this your way of telling me that she's not going to do the show now?
Oh my God, that's peak theater drama.
Big Fatty was ecstatic. He declared it very hard for anyone else to ever beat as a good gosh and gay moment. It just perfectly captured that specific high drama theatrical subculture the segment was about. Proof that, yeah, for some people, rehearsal schedules are life and death stakes.
But the fun didn't last, did it? Because that interview immediately triggered the backlash.
Superb B's voice letter, yeah. Superb B, who Big Fatty had previously called a giant of a man, also a co-host on QCast Connection, remember, called in specifically to react to British John's interview.
And he wasn't happy.
No. This is where the BFO really leans into airing dirty laundry. Superb B's rant was just brutal. Called British John so affected and full of S.
Wow. Okay. Why?
His argument was basically that British John had lived in the U.S. for over 5 years, so he wasn't really British anymore. And all those cultural quirks, like the one-sided toast, Superb B dismissed them as B, just an act.
This is incredible. It's not just podcast beef. It's housemate beef, co-host beef, playing out across different shows, landing right on the BFO.
Exactly. Big Fatty made sure to remind everyone, Superb B, Michael, and British John all live together. That context just adds this thick layer of messy personal podcast politics. The BFO became the perfect stage for these petty feuds to just explode globally.
Okay, the juxtaposition in section four is maybe the wildest yet. We swing from that kind of drama to, well, something very different, starting with Ask the Fat One.
And this segment went to an incredibly explicit technical place this week, thanks to Drunky Bill.
Drunky Bill, described as a gay construction worker, right? A longtime friend from the old Little Fatty Cast days.
Yep. And he called in with a question that was just hyper-specific.
What was it?
His question was, and I quote, what do you do to keep your nose from getting burnt when you're inhaling poppers, when you're bent over?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that is niche and definitely explicit. Establishes the segment is willing to go there.
Absolutely. No topic is too taboo, apparently. But Big Fatty immediately did his clarification thing. Defined poppers for the uninitiated.
Right, not the jalapeno kind.
No. He specified Rush or Jungle Juice.
Mm-hmm.
Amyl nitrate inhalants. So, sets the stage, defines the terms, then delivers the expert advice.
And where did he get this advice? Not from a doctor, I'm guessing.
No. He explicitly stated he learned the technique from watching an expert in the field, Michael Brandon.
Michael Brandon? Who's that?
An owner and star from Raging Stallion Videos, a porn company. Big Fatty added that Brandon supports the Hera Group, whatever that is.
So he's sourcing technical advice about avoiding chemical burns from illicit substances from a porn star?
Correct. The sourcing itself is an editorial statement, isn't it? Totally non-traditional credibility, but hyper-specific to a certain segment of his audience.
What was the actual advice, the solution?
The surprisingly practical, actually. Wipe the top rim of the glass popper's bottle across your forearm before you take a hit.
Why the forearm?
The idea is it wipes off any residual liquid that causes the burn the popper knows. But the skin on your forearm is tougher, so it doesn't get burned itself.
It's incredibly detailed, weirdly helpful, and completely shocking DIY health advice, delivered with utter seriousness.
That's BFO. And then he adds this little cultural footnote just to twist the knife.
Which was?
He mentioned how weird it is that poppers are actually illegal in Amsterdam, even though, as he put it, you can buy everything else effing Amsterdam legally.
That contrast, illegal in liberal Amsterdam, but discussed with clinical detail on the BFO, that's peak early brand identity, chaos delivered with confidence.
But then, to understand the real core appeal, you have to see what came next, right after the poppers discussion.
A hard pivot, I assume.
The hardest pivot imaginable. To a genuinely wholesome, incredibly sweet, Valentine's Day story from his childhood.
Okay, tell me about it.
You flash back to 1962, first grade. His teacher was Mrs. Cox. He even spelled her name C-O-X.
What was the story?
He was homesick on Valentine's Day, had a bad migraine, couldn't go to school. After school, Mrs. Cox walked across the street to his house.
That's nice of her.
And she brought him his Valentine's box. You know, the kind kids decorate. His was wrapped in tinfoil. And she brought him a little chocolate cupcake.
Oh, that's genuinely lovely.
It really is. But the kicker is the longevity of that connection. Mrs. Cox remembered him specifically 12 years later when he's graduating high school. She called his parents' house just to wish him well.
Wow. That shows incredible dedication from a first grade teacher.
Exactly. And Big Fatty used it to illustrate her incredible memory. But sharing that story, that deep affection, that vulnerability, that's what gives him the license for the outrageous stuff.
It makes him human.
Totally. It tells you, look, I'm a real person. I have real feelings, a real past. So you can trust me, even when I'm talking about, you know, poppers or reality TV. The extreme juxtaposition is the genius. It's the structure holding the chaos.
Okay, wrapping up the week, section 5, quirks, culture, logistics. He ties together a few loose ends.
Yeah, current events, travel, money gripes, all filtered through the BFO lens. Started with Monopoly World.
Monopoly.
Yeah. Hasbro was launching a new world edition of Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an online vote. People could vote for 68 different cities to be included on the board. Deadline was Feb 28th.
Did Big Fatty lobby for any particular cities?
Oh, absolutely. This wasn't just news, it was advocacy. He listed his votes. Amsterdam, Sydney, Queenstown, New Zealand, Chicago, Boston, London, Helsinki.
A very specific list.
And he specifically urged listeners to vote for Amsterdam. Referencing the TWWO lips there, tying his personal travel obsession into a board game promotion.
Always on brand. Then he shifted to money.
Yeah, a critique of U.S. currency. Based on an old 60 Minutes story, he remembered, about how much it costs to actually make the money.
And the numbers were absurd.
Totally. It cost 2 cents to make a penny, 10 cents to make a nickel, but only 6 cents to make a paper dollar bill.
So the coins cost more than they're worth, basically.
Exactly. He used it to rant about hating change, which is pretty relatable, and asked that age-old question, why don't they just get rid of the penny?
Did he offer any solutions?
He mentioned New Zealand and Australia had already ditched their small coins. Using that international comparison to highlight American inefficiency, again, it's a small, everyday frustration point that aligns him with the audience. See, I get annoyed by this dumb stuff, too.
And speaking of annoying things, AARP.
Ah, yes. The bane of the newly 50-year-old. He complained that once you hit 50, AARP is just relentless, mail arriving at least once a week, if not two or three times.
Did you join?
He said he gave them the finger, metaphorically, of course,
Yeah.
until they offered him a discount.
A discount on what? Insurance?
Gravel.
Nope. A discount at the Shoney's Buffet.
Shoney's Buffet. That was the price of his principles.
That specific kind of lowbrow concession, that's pure big fatty currency. The organization is a pest, but a cheap buffet. Okay, you got me. That's the acceptable trade-off.
Okay, just a couple of logistical points he covered, showing how he managed the show itself early on. Episode frequency.
Right. He pointed out he'd done 6 episodes the first week, the launch week. But then he immediately set expectations for week 2. It ain't going to be 6 this week. So just too bad.
Establishing the Monday to Friday rhythm, managing expectations.
Exactly. Setting a boundary on his own output. And he also had to defend a segment already. Memory Lane Music.
People were complaining about the old TV themes already. In week 2?
Apparently. But he pushed back. Asserted that the segment seems to be fairly popular. And then laid down the law. If it drives you crazy, then you're just going to have to get over it because Big Fatty is not going to get rid of the Memory Lane Music.
Wow. Declaration of Independence right there.
It's crucial. Week 2, and he's already saying, listener feedback is nice, but this is my show and I'm doing what I like. Ensuring the show stayed true to his very specific idiosyncratic tastes. That's vital for the BFO brand.
And he wrapped the week looking ahead.
Just a quick bit of trivia for the upcoming Monday. President's Day. Mentioned it started in 1971, combining Lincoln's and Washington's birthdays into one holiday for all presidents.
Filler, but structured filler. Fits the mold.
Exactly. Educational, easily digestible factoid, BFO-approved content.
So that was VD Week. We definitely navigated it. What a mix. You had the real warmth, like the Mrs. Cox story, the listener shout-outs.
Real affection, yeah.
And then just extreme explicitness. The poppers thing, superb, be absolutely tearing into British John, the Big Brother Gaydar contest.
It's the paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And what's so fascinating looking back is how fast that paradoxical rhythm got established. That strict format daily show, same segments, 20 minutes, boom, boom, boom. It wasn't a restriction. It was the opposite. It was the reliable container.
The canvas, like you said earlier.
Exactly. That dependable structure gave him the permission, the license, to share the most unfiltered, personal, sometimes really shocking stuff. Because the audience knew, okay, this is wild, but the show structure is solid. It'll be back tomorrow, same time, same format. The structure enabled the chaos.
So thinking about that structure enabling chaos, what's the takeaway for you listening now? Big Fatty built this thing, this community, by taking his own very specific, maybe even slightly embarrassing interests, old TV themes, gossip from his office, reality show predictions, and putting them out there consistently, structurally.
He proved that pretty much no interest is too niche, right? If you present it with confidence, with honesty, with that blend of structure and chaos.
So think about it. What's that niche obsession you have? Something maybe you keep kind of private? Could you give it a platform, a structure? Like, say, a daily 20-minute outlet. Could your very specific passion become the bedrock for its own community?
What detail in your life, whether it's, you know, deeply affectionate like Mrs. Cox or technically explicit like, well, you know, what's waiting to be ruined in the grand BFO tradition? Something to think about.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.